You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
Rewild the Child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to episode 35 of the Untaming podcast. So this is our last interview for the year, but I am splitting it up into two episodes. So check back in next week for the second half of Kevin's interview. I really hope you liked last week's interview with Jackie Wolfe on the history of C-sections. The horrific details of that first recorded caesarean section in America, and also how the electronic fetal monitor has drastically increased the rate of C-sections with no actual statistical improvements, made it one of my favourite episodes. If you follow me on Instagram, you have probably seen that I have recently discovered the Earth's Children series by Jean Owl, which is set in Europe about 20,000 years ago and follows a young orphaned human as she is adopted by a group of Neanderthal and then later when she reconnects with fellow Homo sapiens. The storyline is very good, but it also has a highly detailed focus on botany, herbology, herbal medicine, archaeology and anthropology, which really shows the extent of the knowledge and research by the author. I have been posting some of my favourite quotes on Instagram from the books as I complete them. I'm up to book 4 at the moment, but there is a passage from book 3 that I thought was very relevant, not just to this podcast as a whole, but also to today's episode with Kevin. So I'll just read it out to you. The children were benevolently spoiled. They could eat and sleep where and when they wanted. They seldom observed the territorial customs of their elders. The entire lodge was theirs. They could demand the attention of adult members of the camp and often found it was welcomed as an interesting diversion. No one was in any particular hurry or had any place to go. Wherever their interest led the children, an older member of the group was ready to assist or explain. If they wanted to sew skins together, they were given the tools and scraps of leather and strings of sinew. If they wanted to make stone tools, they were given pieces of flint and stone or bone hammers. They wrestled and tumbled and invented games, which were often versions of adult activities. They made their own small hearths and learned to use fire. They pretended to hunt, spearing pieces of meat from the cold storage chambers and cooked it. When playing hearths extended to mimicking the copulating activities of their elders, the adults smiled indulgently. No part of normal living was singled out as something to be hidden or repressed. All of it was necessary instruction to becoming an adult. The only taboo was violence, particularly extreme or unnecessary violence. Living so close together, they had learned that nothing could destroy a camp or a people like violence, particularly when they were confined to the Earth Lodge during the long cold winters. Whether by accident or design, every custom, manner, convention or practice, even if not overtly directed at it, was aimed at keeping violence to a minimum. Sanctioned conduct allowed a wide range of individual differences in activities that did not, as a rule, lead to violence, or that might be acceptable outlets for draining off strong emotions. Personal skills were fostered, tolerance was encouraged, jealousy or envy, while understood, discouraged. Competitions, including arguments, were actively used as alternatives, but were ritualized, strictly controlled and kept within defined boundaries. The children quickly learned the basic rules. Yelling was acceptable, hitting was not. Now, I don't know how familiar you are with anarchy and anarchism, but they are really two branches of the same tree when it comes to undoing domestication. If you are only vaguely familiar with the term and tend to shy away from it because the mainstream rhetoric has led you to believe it is a dangerous notion, then please try to go into this episode with an open mind. Kevin has over 20 years of experience and research, and what I especially like about him is that he really does know what he's talking about. He may make claims that seem bold about things like politics, colonialism, white supremacist structures, knowledge and specialization, But none of the things he says have come out of thin air. He can back everything he says up, and he's written some excellent books that go deeper into, much, much deeper into everything we cover. If you find today's episode depressing, note that the second half next week is more encouraging. Oh, and a warning that there is some colourful language used. Forty-year-old Kevin Tucker was born in Cincinnati, Ohio, grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, and currently lives in rural Pennsylvania with his wife Natasha and the four children in their care, ranging in ages from 8 to 9. Kevin Tucker is a primal anarchist writer focused on uncovering how our communal past of living in nomadic hunter-gatherer bands, without storage, without production, has shaped us. The core of Kevin's work is to fully grasp the consequences of civilization and the ways in which it permeates and limps along, to rewild our lives, rebuild community, and resist civilization. He is the author of three books, For Wildness and Anarchy, Gathered Remains, and The Cull of Personality, and is currently working on his fourth book, The Gospel of Empire. He is also the founding editor of Wild Resistance, editor and contributor to Green Anarchy magazine, co-founder of the Black and Green Network, and the co-host of the Primal Anarchy podcast with his wife Natasha. Last night he had 5 to 6 hours of sleep, and for dinner tonight he had burgers. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So I first came upon you, I think, over 10 years ago. I was in my early 20s, and my understanding of politics at the time was as simple as left and right. And one day the thought popped into my head, is there something outside of this left and right spectrum? So a bit of Googling led me to anarchism and Black and Green Press. But I'm a bit ashamed to admit it all went totally over my head at the time. And it wasn't until about 3 or so years ago when I first discovered the term rewilding and how much it had to do with the way my life and worldview had evolved that I Googled rewilding, which took me to Green Anarchy, and then once again back to Black and Green Press. So I've since listened to every episode of your podcast twice.
Wow.
And bought all three of your books. Personally, I now identify as an anarchist, but what I find challenging is defining it for others. I know there's like a connotation of danger associated with it, chaos, violence, like a lack of empathy. But I'm really enjoying your book For Wildness and Anarchy at the moment. And you put it so well that there's so much more to anarchism than politics, that it's about social connection. So I wondered if you could start off by telling us, just in layman's terms, if you can, what is anarchism and how are rewilding and anarchism connected? And what does primal anarchy mean?
All right. So I find it interesting that even over the last few podcasts, and I've been doing a primal anarchy, a brief history course. I think I've done it 2 or 3 times now. And it's, you know, I'm not the kind of person that just like writes a script and then follows it every time and anything like that. It's like, it's got to be responding to what's happening. But even just like how we've had to do the last few podcasts and the last interviews I've been doing, like it's changing now more every single time than any other time. I've been an anarchist for 27 years. So it's like anarchism is a word that is becoming more and more prevalent in the world. And the more prevalent it's becoming, the more I'm having to add all these other asterisks because there's these just different directions about it. So even the way that I would have described it, and For Wildness and Anarchy, there's still a lot to it. And at the same time, just the way that the world is changing right now and the way that fascism is really on the rise, we really have to keep like adding more and more connotations. So, you know, it's not uncommon for people to have that left-right dynamic for politics, and that's it. And I mean, with anarchism, this is still an issue. But anarchism, broadly put, the thing that connects everything is it's just really that term anarchy, without like literally breaking down to the words, the etymology of it is anarchy or anarchos, without government, without civics, you know, whatever way you kind of splice it. the basis of the word is without government. So what it means to be an anarchist is to be a person who wants to live without government. You know, when we're talking about primal anarchy, and something we'll get to in a minute, you know, there's a big difference between what an anarchistic society actually looks like and also why an anarchistic society functions the way it does and why people who live with an anarchistic society would never have to call themselves anarchists. You know, those are all kind of like big issues and stuff, but really what it implies if you're saying I'm an anarchist is because I want to live in anarchy. So the question that's really driven anarchist debate, anarchist discussion, the question that's driven anarchism is really the definition of what does it mean to be without government. And there's a number of different takes on it, and some of those takes are being more articulated now than others. I had typically kind of said, like, the main split between anarchists was really, like, this, like, red anarchist versus green anarchist split. And red anarchists are what we call, like, traditional anarchists, anarcho-syndicalists, anarcho-communists. Basically, like, it's a reflection of this, like, European-led movement that came out of Europe and starting in, like, the mid-1800s up through, like, the early 1900s into now, and it's continually, like, articulated, but most of the anarchist thinkers that we associate with or become the associations come from that era. And it's, like, a very specific thing. It's very much tied to workers' rights, workers' movements, and industrializing countries. But, you know, looking at the world right now, it's like, all right, well, this is a small piece of it. And there's all kinds of things we'll get into for sure. But like indigenous anarchism is increasingly coming about, discussion about land back. And then something I've been saying repeatedly on the podcast and all these other platforms is like, we just need to destroy the Western tradition. The entire Western tradition is stuck in this lineage. It's not going anywhere. And it's stuck in this European philosophy. But, you know, that's kind of the way that we tend to view things within civilization, within modernity. We're stuck within this Western idealized notions and all these ideas about revolution and this whole thing of even thinking that the only options for resisting civilization, resisting empire, resisting the domestication of our being really comes down to, like, it must be left or it must be right. It must be within this kind of dichotomy, within this narrative that we've been given about the way the world works and the way that the world has been developed. And so it really gets you kind of pigeonholed into these ideas of being like, well, these are the options. And for anarchism, this lineage comes down from, we got Proudhon, we got Berkman, we got Kropotkin, we got Bakunin, we got Goldman, you know, all these people, and they build this very specific thing. It's like, all right, well, you know, green anarchism came about because it said, it's like, all right, red anarchists were saying that work, you know, kind of, you know, in a very crass way, work will set you free if you own the means of production. But, you know, the rest of us are like, well, we're familiar with the phrase work will set you free now. That's what was on the cage of death camps. That's not how we're defining ourselves. This isn't right. This isn't for us. This isn't what it was meant to be. And green anarchism has, you know, really taken on this whole other thing of saying, it's like, okay, well, we're not just talking about the state. We're talking about not just talking about government. We're talking about civilization. And so I tend to focus on in a number of different ways. Like, the question of what is government, what is the state, is really like your understanding of, like, where does power lie? Where does power originate? Where does this centralized power come from? What is it that you are looking to consider your enemy and take on? So, like, red anarchy versus green anarchy was this question about, like, you know, does it come through labor? Does it come through, like, your relationship with the world? Does it come through the kind of communities and mutual aid networks that you're building up? But there's another kind of current to it as well, which is what we're seeing a lot more of now, which is this kind of, like, individualistic libertarian sense, the egoist kind of thing, which can go back to, like, Max Stirner. And then you're seeing the more communalist aspects of it, which for the most part just got funneled into communism. But, you know, I mean, there's just, like, this other side of it. But when you're talking about, you know, the kinds of anarchism you're seeing in the world right now, something like anarcho-capitalism wasn't really something that we saw much of for a very long time. And all of a sudden now, libertarians have really just turned towards anarchism. And it's just like, well, if I'm talking about without government, I mean, how does the state relate to me personally? How, and like going down to this anarchist, Pierre Proudhon, who's one of the founding anarchists from the European tradition, his whole question was, what is property? And, you know, I'm not really interested in really like delving into a lot of the ins and outs of all that stuff. And I'm sure a lot of people don't want to hear about it, but like at the same time, you can look at a lot of it and say it's the cart before the horse. Like people are really like, if we're jumping in to talk about state power and political power, and you're like, well, what about private property? It's like, all right, we're missing a much bigger picture here. But if you do come in from that angle, then it really, if that's the starting point, that's where the whole libertarian side comes in. And that's where like a lot of the fascists really have crept in. It's just like, government should exist to support me. And like anarcho-capitalists are saying, it's like the government should leave the market completely free. But the degree that there's any kind of sense with power within libertarian struggles and things like that, it's just to defend the individual's right to be the individual and live as this like fractured little being throughout the world. Which, I mean, frankly, to me, just like this is batshit crazy stuff, but obviously it's taking hold. I mean, this is the fascist trajectory through and through. So you have this, like, not only do you have the side of being like, what is power? Is it about, you know, government? Is it about the state? Is it about civilization and industrialism? But also, like, is it about empowering the individual, or like to be defend themselves against other individuals, and the sense of freedom that is just atomized down to being each individual person as like an island? Or is it about building and defending kind of communities? So within that is this other question. Like, this whole view of anarchism for some people is like, if I'm looking at anarchism as a term without government, then I'm like just saying, okay, we're just going to remove government from the equation. Which is really stupid. And the reason that anarchism is even on the political spectrum at all is because you're talking about like ways in which a society is governed or not governed. But still, you're talking about the way a society functions. So for a person like me, who's like very much like we're meant to live as hunter-gatherers, but this is how we've been shaped by evolution, this is how we've been meant to be, this is how the most egalitarian societies have existed, is as nomadic hunter-gatherers. Then the role of the individual is like some totally foreign thing. We're talking about communities. We're talking about societies. So anarchism, from my perspective, or anarchistic perspective, from perspective like mine, isn't just a question of like, well, without government, but what does a society without government look like? What does a society without government do? How does it look? How does it function? So it's almost like, like I said, because of fascism, because of all these things that are changing, all these things that are keep coming up, like really having to define and redefine to this obnoxious degree, which is another reason that like it was really important for me to make this distinction about primal anarchy, because anarchism can mean a million different things to a million different people. These things split along all these lines, and then there's just like these ridiculous, these tedious arguments and all these things, and it's not that they don't have their merit, but when I'm talking about primal anarchy, you know, the primal is really just like, you know, initial, this aspect of our being, this makeup of who we are, millions of years of evolution as a social animal. You know, when you step back and you look at this, it's like, okay, we're not talking about a European theory. We're not talking about something that existed or grew up alongside communism and socialism and democracy and all these other ideas that we associate or have been associated with like Western thinking. But like, this is a successful existence, and the most egalitarian existence that's ever been known. And it makes up almost the entirety of our existence as humans on this earth. Like, this is the thing that's within us. This is what shapes us. This is what drives the way we see, the way we run, the way we interact with the world, the way we interact with each other, the way we interact with everything around us. And it's one of those things that, you know, I have been kind of pushing and pulling with this in different ways to kind of work down to really get to a level of understanding with this that made sense, because there's still aspects of like, even if you're moving beyond the left-right spectrum or something like that, you still get kind of stuck in reiterating some of these ideas that civilization tends to say all the time. You get stuck in these narratives of thinking these are the only options. So we see things as like ecology or politics or sociology as all these different segments and fragments of a society that mirror into every different society. And you have all these different elements, and it's like, okay, well, we're going to address this one or this one or this one. It's like, all right, like when you get down, the reason that anarchy, this primal anarchy, the reason that nomadic hunter-gatherer societies and these truly egalitarian anarchistic societies actually function is because they don't have any of that. Like they don't have these pathologies we've had driven into us to divide the world into all these different pieces and say, it's like, well, how do I articulate myself in this sphere or this sphere or that sphere? It's like, well, no, you just know people and you just deal with them. You just understand you have these relationships with people and they make sense. You have relationships with the land. You have relationships with the animals, the trees, the plants. Every single thing has its place and has its function. And it doesn't have this like multi-tiered kind of existence where, you know, your expectation for how you would interact with the world or how you'd interact with everything else would be completely set to a different set of rules. It's like all these artificial divisions, they really just need to be just gone. They need to be removed from the equation. That's what it's like. I think it's very important to say. It's like this is something that's totally different. Primal anarchy isn't just like another European theory. This isn't just like another idea of saying, well, what if we were going to create a society and it were to look like this? Or it's just like, I want to just remove government from the equation and the rest of the stuff necessarily makes sense. It's like, well, the reason government came into the equation, the reason that we can't get past it is because we're still doing this division. And rewilding, you know, there's a lot to say about it. There's a lot to say about the term. There's a lot to say about the movement. Natasha and I have really kind of like gone back and forth considerably about saying, like, do we even identify with the term necessarily anymore? And I think that on a base level, it's like the idea of it is good. And it also agrees with this primal anarchy. If you're saying rewild, the presumption is wildness is the state from which you were removed. You're coming back to it. Mm-hmm. It does have that same kind of baseline built into it, even if it's not articulated often, but it still has that tendency. And as we've seen through the rewilding movement, it has the same kind of habits of just breaking the world apart and being like, all right, well, this rewilding aspect is separate from resistance to civilization. It's separate from all these different aspects of society. And it's, you know, about my connection in terms of building a skill set, in terms of, in some degrees, ecological relationships, in terms of spiritual and personal relationships with the land, with other people. And then, of course, the big, you know, elephant in the room is just that so much of it became this whole avenue for prepping and for like building this spectacular looking ordeal where everybody I know has agents in TV shows. Because it's just like it was something that was became so easily absorbed by Discovery or by any of these TV stations or any of these channels. I mean, I guess TV stations are irrelevant for the most part now, but any of these avenues by which all these things are kind of falling about are just falling back into this like survivalist trap, this individualist trap of like, well, how are you going to survive against the wild? How are you going to conquer it? And how are you going to get past it? And it's like all this prepping nonsense that we're like, well, the whole point of rewilding was move beyond that stuff, but it's become another avenue for it. So at the same time, it's like, I think that ethos was important for, you know, saying about reconnecting to really understand about what it means to be involved in subsistence and to really kind of break down some of these barriers. At the end of the day, like Natasha and I talking about it and some other people talking about it that have been involved in the whole thing, primal anarchy really is meant to just encompass the idea of like, What I took as the core of rewilding, which a lot of people I think have taken in different directions. For me, a lot of like the environmentalist stuff, a lot of the ecologist stuff is really about observation. Rewilding for me, I always separated as saying it was about integration. So if that's the case, then, you know, you can move past that term. Like the idea of primal anarchy is like this spirit is here. It's always existing. This entire other narrative that we've been blinded from and told and sold otherwise, told that it doesn't exist, it's all here. It's all within you. It's just one spirit that's like fighting and struggling and trying to come out. And it's not about going to a wilderness place. It's not about looking back to a certain point in time or place and idealizing that, but saying like, this is this impulse that is never dying, that is never going away. And it's more important that we just don't continue going down this path of saying, well, I'm into rewilding and I'm into anarchism. I'm into resistance and this is how I relate resistance to rewilding. It's like, it's all the same thing. And it's very crucial that it is seen that way. So it's like Natasha and I both really said, the term rewilding is kind of dead to us in a lot of ways. And it's just more important to say, it's like, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing this fractured worldview anymore. This is what I'm talking about. Anarchy, primal anarchy is this egalitarian way of being that was built into who we are. And it's an unsegmented way of living with the world that is focused on societies and communities, human and non, being integrated into this whole that is resisting civilization. And within all that is this non-hierarchical, uncategorized, just existence in which, our place is not a question anymore.
Yeah, that was good. Thank you. Heading now to more like hunter-gatherer societies, what sort of standout features make them superior to our civilized existence?
Well, normally I'd say like words like superior, I'd be like, but in this case, yeah. I mean, hunter-gatherer existence is unquestionably superior to civilization. I mean, just the fact that like all the problems that we've been trying to solve, and personally my quest along anarchism and like kind of some of the subtext for some of these distinctions I'm making, like talking about the different sides of anarchism, just have to do with my own quest to try and understand and undo like all the stories, all the narratives, and all the lies that go into building a human being that's going to be a part of this fragmented civilization. And so you can really see all these different levels in which like the problems that you've tried to solve, if you come at it as I feel like I have, to be like totally honest, like with a lot of stuff with anarchism, I came into it as an anarcho-syndicalist, a red anarchist, who was deeply moved by earth and animal liberation movements. I was working with indigenous resistance movements. Ecofeminism was a huge thing for me. I was coming from this like anarcho-punk background that had a lot of anti-industrial like trappings and anti-modernity, which I should say is not the same as like anti-modernization, and not necessarily like the way that it's being taken now, where that's like a dog whistle for all right wolves of Vinland kind of nonsense, like neo-barbarian shit. Man, it's getting harder. It's getting harder every day with all these insane fascist and militia groups popping up, and like even now, like the big term for a lot of them is paleo neocon or whatever. the usurpation of the language is making it problematic to even just like say this is how I got into it or whatever. Let me just say the terms were different. The playing field was a bit different with some of the terms. Anyways, if you're trying to understand how you would solve, like coming from an anarchist perspective, it's like, what would an anarchist society look like if it were going to be ecologically sound? What would a hunter-gatherer society look like if it was going to be rid of patriarchy and it wasn't going to be dependent upon like straight heterosexual relationships and like this dual gender kind of nonsense, all the stuff that we've thrown in and baked into all of our understandings about civilization and the way the world runs. And what we find is that if you keep kind of pulling on all these strings, if you keep trying to undo them and approach these problems individually, and you get that understanding that like nomadic hunter-gatherer existence is 99.99% of our existence, or the majority of our existence, and there's still all these groups that exist now that are still struggling to sustain themselves or maintain themselves in light of colonialism and its onslaught, then you realize these aren't problems that these societies are having to deal with on any kind of intentional level, outside of the fact that our need for resources, our need for all these like slaves and all these things that civilization demands and colonialism demands, those things intrude upon these societies, but they're not having to sit here and have meetings about how to figure this out. And if you're trying to understand from an ecological aspect or from just like sociological aspect how these societies function, again, the thing that makes it so that it's so impressive, and they're not saying that we're anarchists or anything like that, and we're not having meetings, is that it really just functions. Like, from a social animal perspective, from all these different things, you can see the things that we need as a social animal are pretty simple. We need subsistence. We need space. We need to understand that the nature of existence is that we love stories. We love being around other people, but we also get sick of people. We also have problems with people. We have relationships that won't necessarily last. We have people that we're not going to necessarily get along with. And also, being in one place too long can be way too harsh on the environment. And it's anti-ecological. Being dependent upon 5 to 10 plants or 5 to 10 plants and animals doesn't really make any ecological sense. Like, the resiliency that we have as a being, as an entity within the world, really is reflected in the way that hunter-gatherers engage with the world. So when you're talking about hunter-gatherer society, you talk about it's broken down into camps. And I say nomadic, and I think people probably get the idea as like, oh, they're always moving. And there are societies that do move a lot. Typically, those movements coincide with having to evade colonialism. So that's that's a pretty big fucking issue. Yeah. But like, as a whole, what it really means is that you live within a land base, and you're considered that land base your home. It's not like I'm just going to go and find someplace new. It's like you just know the area, so you can just move around. And, you know, when you look at the makeup of hunter-gatherer camps, there can be some that are 10 people and some that are 100 people. The average is going to be like 25, 35, 45. And in some societies, a percentage of people who would identify with any one camp, maybe a third of the people who are there at the time, a third of relatives, a third of people who married in, and people just kind of filtering in and out. It's like all the problems that we're trying to solve, because we're really built into this like passive aggressive, but also aggressive aggressive behavior and pattern. It makes it so that we're not able to acknowledge the things in life that are hard. And so we were willing to offset those problems and the problem solving things that we come about with that, that comes down to extraction, that comes down to religion, it comes down to suppression of people based along, you know, gender, sex, whatever. We've created all these institutions and all these different ways of dealing with things that people who are free, people who are able to subsist, people who have the ability to share and to get along and mitigate conflict, which is a huge thing, conflict mitigation, conflict resolution. They're able to just say, these are the parts of life that are hard. And we're going to have, you know, we have healing rituals. We have ways of communicating. We have ways of dealing with mourning. We have ways of dealing with pain. We have ways of dealing with suffering. And we also have that baseline understanding of just saying, sometimes people don't get along and they cause a fight. The easiest thing to do is to have a society structured in such a way that that person's got somewhere else they can go. You can get mad at somebody and have a fight, or you can get mad at somebody and feel this tension building. They can just go somewhere else. You can go somewhere else. It's not like a consequential thing. It's not the situation you have within societies that have surplus, societies that have agriculture, where there is something being produced and people are being invested in a certain level of production. Instead, you have this level of procurement where people are just hunting and gathering, like literally going and hunting and gathering or scavenging for food for, you know, any kind of given amount of time. It really frees people from, you know, having to be beholden to some larger structure, beholden to some larger infrastructure that creates situations where tensions are going to have to be a continual issue that you either suppress or you ritualize through warfare cycles. So it's just, you know, again, a part of this unlearning process, a part of this breaking down and saying, where does power lie? Where does power come from? And then you see it's like, oh, all the questions we've been trying to answer are actually answered in this society. And this is the way that it functions. And it's not like it just like shuts off. You know, I mean, when I talk about like immediate and delayed return societies, it's not that there's like the thing, and this is part of the thing about primal anarchy, and part of the reason why I went from, you know, I consider myself an anarcho-primitivist for a long time, and this is a discussion that another anarcho-primitivist friend of mine, John Zerzan, and I, and the other editors with Wild Resistance had, was, you know, the way that we viewed anarcho-primitivism, which again is another thing that, because Facebook has gone in insane directions and has gone even fascist directions and full-on right positions, it's not how it was. But the premise of it was about asking these questions: where does civilization originate from? Where are the origins of power? Where are the origins of control? And we got to the point where we're asking all these questions, and it's like, you know, the reason to switch from that to just looking at primal anarchy is like, all right, well, we know. Like, we understand on a very real level, like, where these things originate from. We're focusing on this. But one of the trappings about asking those questions was you could create the situation, as critics of anarcho-primitivism had, to say, like, well, you're isolating everything into nomadic hunter-gatherers, and once it's gone, then genie's out of the bottle, apples fallen from the tree, Eve's eaten it, and we're out of the Garden of Eden, blah, blah, blah. All these, like, religious nonsense that we don't have anything to do with. It really set up for a lot of those trappings. And this, by understanding primal anarchy as the baseline, you can see how, like, that's something that doesn't go away. This is the tendency we have. And frankly, all the societies that have even minutia of control in them have to struggle against. So you look at the work of somebody like an anthropologist like Pierre Clastres. He's talking about, like, how chiefs in horticultural societies were, like, it was, you called it the society against the state, is that there's all these fail safes within the society to check a chief or to check the kind of power they had and keep it from being absolute. It's like, well, that's primal anarchy. That's like this legacy of not wanting to be dominated or being subjected. Yeah. And it's having to evolve to these different situations. But, like, it's really this beautiful, amazing thing. And it's something that exists still. Obviously, we're having this conversation. And we're probably pretty damn far removed from being actual hunter-gatherers. We're having a discussion halfway across the world over computers.
Yeah.
But this is just, like, a really important aspect of it. It's like, okay, we're asking the wrong questions in a way. We're coming about this all wrong because we're trying to pick apart our own pathologies and find it in fragments. And it's like, oh, we just need to be looking at it further away. We need to be, like, taking bigger steps to remove more of our own issues in the way that we ask questions and really get out.
Yeah.
Really get out of these Western traditions.
Hmm. I think it seems to be quite a widespread misconception that we are more intelligent than hunter-gatherers. You know, things like mobile phones, the internet, air and space travel are commonly touted. And on top of that, the belief that we have a much better quality of life. So I know you've got a lot to say on this.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely do. But I mean, the biggest thing that I always think about, like, there's, I'm forgetting his name. Kevin Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
He was a founder of Wired magazine. He's, like, one of the people who was, like, always preaching about technology and about how smarter it's made us. And he said at one point that if you want to see the face of God, look inside of an iPhone. It's like, all right. Like, the thing that will kill every civilization, the thing that ends every empire, is hubris. Like, this ridiculous notion of just feeling like we're equated with a society. I mean, when you look at it, especially now, when you look at the way the world is right now, like, we have a global pandemic going on. Every continent is dealing with things differently. And, you know, I know, like, even America, everybody's like, we're in fascism, we're on the verge of fascism, people are looking to jump ship and they want to go somewhere, you know, for them totally different. And I see people talking about it going to Australia. It's like, history of Australia is parallel to ours.
Yeah.
And the treatment of refugees is not better than is being handled here. It's like, there's all these weird kind of colonial fantasies of thinking you can just escape. Man, there's just so many aspects about the way that we approach the world and the way that we oversimplify it and the way that we relate to it that are just the embodiment of colonialism, the embodiment of this imperialistic relationship with the world and this parasitic extractivist relationship with the world. So while we have all these things happening, we have this pandemic, we have all this going on, we have the greatest wealth disparity in recorded history, and you know, and especially here in the States, we have massive UNRWAs, massive uprisings going on. Like, the white supremacist core of civilization is undisputable. And yet people are still doing this thing where we're identifying with the society as a whole and the products that is produced as though they're any indication of what any of us knows. And so if you want to take a look at Kevin Kelly's example and you want to take a look at a cell phone, okay, there's not probably a single person alive on this entire planet who could assemble a cell phone from start to finish. Like, get all the parts, get all the pieces, put them together. Like, not even if you're including the networks, not if you're including cell phone towers, not if you're including fiber optic cables, all that stuff, put all that stuff aside. Nobody on Earth knows that. Nobody on Earth knows that. It's just like accumulated knowledge that's built by specialists. And also, we're all frantically in debt involved in it. And then we're just, we don't even understand the ways in which all of our information is continually being processed and used as data points to be sold by capitalists. So to think there's intelligence behind any of this stuff, it's like, man, this is the ultimate case of just like, you know, falling in love with your captor. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, I have this, identify this thing. It's like, well, despite everything, I've got a cell phone. It's like, okay, you can't afford it. You don't want it. It helps you connect with the world because you're horribly depressed and because you're lacking community. You're lacking all these things in your life and you're looking for it. And it's telling you it's all here, which is how domestication works. It's how just civilization works. It sees the needs that you have as a social animal, tears apart, and sells it to you piecemeal through things like cell phones or social networks and things like that. But nobody in this world, nobody within these civilized societies really has the ability to manifest any one of these things. Nobody has ownership over any one of these technologies. And if they do, they don't have ownership over the global network that's used to rape and pillage the world to get all the components. And we were talking about down to child soldiers and working mines, like shanty mines in Africa, or you're talking about this coup that's being spearheaded by Elon Musk to try and get cobalt mines in South America. Like, all these different aspects of it's like, okay, the ideal that you're upholding is unattainable for you, unsustainable for you, unsustainable for the world, but also impossible, and nobody has any control over it, nobody has any ownership over it. We don't have any knowledge or skill that actually gets us anywhere in life. We have no subsistence knowledge that we're baked into. We're put into this survivalish situation where we're dependent upon paychecks to go buy food from a grocery store. Nearly all of the world is probably just at best one or two paychecks away from complete poverty. And yet we're still like identifying with the system that oppresses us. So one of the things that really amazed me, and Four-Legged Human is somebody else who's been involved with the journal Wild Resistance, which was called Black Green Review before that. And he had this essay in one of the issues, and it was like, some of these pictures to me, that he had found a bone scraper when he was out in the Kalahari, and also one that was out in the fields in Wyoming. And they're just like sitting out in the open because they're relatively similar, like in ecology and in some degrees, they're in relatively ecologically similar areas where you could leave something in the plains, you could leave something in the Kalahari, and it's just going to sit there for the most part. It's not like a dense forest. It's not like a riverbed that's going to wash it away. And they're undated. They're not necessarily even datable in some degrees, but the scraper tool is something that's been around for like a million years. And here's one from Africa and here's one from Wyoming. These places are extremely far apart. And the time and space between these two things are far apart, but the scrapers are almost exactly the same. This functionality of the tools, like, you know, that's something that people knew how to do. They knew how to make. Like, a stone tool didn't need to be something extravagant. It didn't need to be a conversation piece. I mean, it could be used for, like, you know, you can make jewelry or whatever, and people just liked it and embellished who they were. But they come and they go. Mm. Like, there's no point in being obsessed with the tools you use to communicate. You should be obsessed with the communication. And thus, the content is completely deprived and washed away from every aspect of your being. There's no reason to care about the ways of communication or the method of communication, the tool of communication, over the communication itself. So the ingenuity of hunter-gatherers, the ingenuity of life without civilization, is everybody had the ability to make these tools, to make tools that were usable. They could be better, they could be worse. But, I mean, really, all they needed to be was functional. That's really the demanding thing. And, I mean, even within the rewilding movement, we've gone apeshit with this. And people just, like, you know, thinking that you're going to live wild because you can just, like, off-carve spoons. Like, yeah, sure, there's beautiful artistry involved in it. And I'm not sitting here trying to dog on anybody for doing it or making something that looks beautiful or feeling some sense of value because they're involved with the direct production of something that could be used for procurement or subsistence. But again, we have that same kind of tool mentality of thinking, well, we're smarter, we're going to get past this or whatever. The ingenuity is in building and having tools and knowledge and the ability to subsist on your own, but also wanting to be with other people. And instead of spending your time building crafts to, like, relate to other people or communicate with other people, to work on the actual communication. Like, I'd rather be poor in technology and rich in stories. Like, at what point in our existence did that scale tip? And the reason that it did tip is because nobody's talking about it that way. Nobody's going to contextualize and say, it's like, well, you could have all the stories in the world. People are like, well, I want actors. I want Mozart. I want Shakespeare. I want fine cheese and this and that and the other. I was like, no, you're talking about all these things that you relate to the world because you become a consumer. We have a consumer relationship with the world, and what you become is a spectator. So, like, there is wonderful music, and I'm a musician. I love music. I love hearing it, and there's music that if civilization collapsed tomorrow, 10 years from now, if I'm still around, I'll have, you know, carcass stuck in my head. Like, it's just the nature of it. Like, we all love music, it doesn't matter. But we can't put the spectator sport over the involvement, over the community aspect of what it means to be human, what it means to be part of a human community, what it means to be a storyteller or have stories that move and change and have meaning and grant you more room and place with where you are and where you want to be. So the idea that we continually have this thing, it was like, well, we're smarter. It's like, well, we're relating to consumer goods as a version of our identity. Like, that's the core problem of capitalism. And that's something we're just straight up reiterating. And then as far as, you know, things like better quality of life, no. Like, we're coming from, like, the most supposedly developed advanced civilization that there ever was, and we're miserable. As you look at the United States right now, and it's a buffet of dumpster fires. Nobody is happy here. Everybody's miserable. Everybody hates everything. Everybody hates each other. You know, there's no quality of life. So even before you want to get into quantity of life, we've got quality of life issues that are endemic, but also extremely tied to white supremacist structures, like the survival rate for, you know, black infants and things like that in the United States versus white infants, it cuts down drastically. And there's no question about the forms of white supremacy that are involved in access to healthcare, or involved in, you know, are you going to be able to get a credit card loan? Are you going to be able to get health insurance? Are you going to be able to get any of these things? I mean, there's huge racism structure involved with all these things. So the fact that we identify with it, you know, a lot of times it's like this complex of, like, how much are you identifying with your captor? How much are you identifying with your consumer goods? How much are you willing to just, like, put on the line for this belief that things are better? And realistically, they're just not. Like, hunter-gatherer livelihood, hunter-gatherer longevity is a lot better than we want to give it credit for being. That's for damn sure. But when you look at, you know, especially like something like the colonies, like Virginia, Roanoke, and stuff like that, and when the settler states, when they were first being founded in the United States, lifespan is like 25. And areas of industrializing world, turn of the century, 1800s, 1900s, 20 or 30 years old. The life of colonizers is short and miserable. And if you want to look at the way that civilization functions, you don't get to just pick and choose what part of the world you're going to choose for what the life expectancy is. If you want to talk about the life expectancy of people within this civilization, then you can't just pick like affluent whites in any city in America or Australia or something like that, or some like horrible like South Africa. You know, you have to take into account the death tolls in places like Syria and Afghanistan, where there's been ongoing relentless warfare and children being subject for decades to depleted uranium stocks, child mines, child warriors, child soldiers throughout much of, like, you know, the third world, much of the southern hemisphere in particular, children who are being trafficked and stolen from indigenous families in the northern hemisphere and southern hemisphere as well. There's a horror story on every aspect of civilization that is absolutely being ignored by these things, because we just want to be able to say quantifiably, we've got the data, we've got the charts, we've got the consumer patterns, we've got the consumer goods that show we're better off and we have better stuff. And the flip side of it is none of us can afford it. And those of us who have it, it's not making our lives any better.
Mm. Now, to avoid romanticizing of hunter-gatherers, what parts of their lifestyle do not appeal to you?
I mean, I guess the hard part about it is that, and I had a friend who once said, it's like, you know, people talk about romanticizing the past, which of course, I said there's a whole bunch of questions and problems about equating hunter-gatherers with the past, is that, you know, the inverse of it is romanticizing the present. And so, you know, again, this is something that I've spent a lot of time focusing on, the issue, or I'm sorry, my book Gathered Remains. There's two huge essays in it. One is Hooked on a Feeling and the other is Society Without Strangers. And they both look at, from a very direct view intentionally, one of the, Hooked on a Feeling is about the rise of addiction and Society Without Strangers is about violence. And I open Society Without Strangers talking about a case of what would be considered extreme violence amongst the Bushmen of the Kalahari. There's a case in which somebody had just like lost their mind and killed two people, and in response the group chose to kill this person. So like three homicides is beyond significant. There's a whole lot of issues that come about the complexity of those moments and what happens because of colonialism and what happens that's surrounding all of that. But I wanted to bring that up because I wanted to say, it's like, you know, if we're talking about what it looks like to be a hunter-gatherer, when you're talking about what it looks like to be an anarchistic society, then you're talking about, like, yeah, getting rid of the cops, getting rid of the prisons, getting rid of all these institutions. So it means that you are now having to deal with the problems instead of default them, which, again, has a lot of questions of privilege involved in it as well. But that's something I wanted to look at because, like, this was the extreme case that went against the norm. The norm in most hunter-gatherer societies, they teach children from a very young age that the violence is something to be avoided and how to deal with conflict resolution. So like most societies, like most hunter-gatherer societies generally have actually zero homicides. And so, you know, there's a whole lot to build about that, but I wanted to look at something that we would consider ugly. And another thing that comes up in that essay and talking about, you know, with Hooked on a Feeling, before you had the use of intoxicants and things like that for reaching in a euphoric state as a community, you have like hands-on healing methods, people singing and dancing together, like as a community. And I say that the reason that people have this is, like, the thing that I think is so ingenious about this, and again, when I talked about primal anarchy and really being able to say, we're going to put the nasty things up front and say this is something that we're going to have to be prepared to deal with, is, like, so ingenious, is because, like, shit does happen. And you're talking about how in this society, I know, and I'm sure plenty of other people have known people who've had miscarriages. And the way that miscarriages are handled in this society is typically silently, typically alone. There's degrees of shame that are built into it, and there's no degree or a kind of weird degree of public mourning associated with it. And in general, mourning and grief are issues we do not deal with. And Natasha, I think, has done a really fucking awesome job talking about that stuff. But, like, hunter-gatherer societies do have an understanding of this. They do have an understanding that not every child that's born is going to live. They have ways of dealing with all these things that do hurt. And also to be able to say, not only is it possible that they can happen, but that they will hurt, and there's patterns for mourning, and there's ways that people can deal with these things, and ways that people can be supported to make sure that trauma isn't the result of it. Like, horrible things still happen. how do you have the cultural understanding to make it possible so that that person can go on living without being stuck in that trauma? So do I romanticize hunter-gatherers? No, I'm specifically saying the things that happen as a social animal that are horrible in any society, or things that would be extremely hard to deal with as any society and as a parent. Like the idea of like losing children is exceptionally hard to deal with. It's exceptionally hard to look at. So I'm like saying, this is something that can happen here, it can happen there. But they have a whole other thing. These societies can, the way that we interact with the world can have this whole other thing.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not romanticizing it. I'm saying it's like, these are things that can happen anywhere. But conversely, the thing that fucking pisses me off about this kind of question is like, my brother, three days ago, it was the 20-year anniversary of my brother dying from heroin overdose. I've lost siblings to heroin. I've lost family to suicide. I've had to struggle lifelong with depression. I suffer from PTSD. I've had horrific things happen to me and my brother as a child. I have dissociative identity disorder, which is something that used to be considered multiple personality disorder. Before people had a really better understanding of what it is, but it's early childhood, severe earlyhood childhood trauma that causes your brain to kind of fracture to deal with that trauma, to compartmentalize it into alters and into parts.
Yeah.
We always talk about this thing within civilizations, always this quote, and specifically like religious leaders and things like that are saying, it's like, don't judge a society on anything else but how they treat their children. Well, the worst things you could possibly do to any human being, we do to children in the society. And not just in our own society, but children across the border. There's children in cages in this country right now, in the United States, right fucking now. There are ICE detention centers that are filled with children. And they have been separated from their parents. They had no means, they had no interest in ever involving the parents of those kids ever again in their lives. And the history of civilization here, happens in Australia, it happens in Canada, it happens everywhere, is that indigenous children are stolen from their parents 100% of the time. They're typically sold into child trafficking rings or slavery rings to become production agents within mines, within agriculture, within brick making facilities. There's massive schools in India right now that are based on stealing indigenous children out of the forest and bringing them there to become industrial workers. And that industrial residential school program has its mirrors in right where I'm at. I'm about 30 or 40 miles down from what was Carlisle Indian School or Carlisle Industrial School, you know, a couple hundred years ago. It's like the school that was built on acculturating stolen indigenous children. When you go there, it's an active military base right now, and the entire front of that building is gravestones marked with children's names or tribal affiliations, because children were never even named and they never even know their name. They didn't care about their name. They just tried to get them there and they died because they didn't want to be split from their families. They didn't want to be split from the communities, which they knew. Like, so people want to talk about romanticizing. We need to get our heads out of our asses and take a realistic assessment about what is happening within civilization and all the things that are happening across the world in front of our faces, in front of our eyes, that we are not dealing with. So like, the worst thing that can happen within a hunter-gatherer society, within any society, should be that a child dies. And here, these societies have that as an understanding that this can happen, and they've found a way to work with it because it's just the nature of existence that these things can happen. And the alternate is that we're saying we've conquered this problem somehow. And meanwhile, it's unfolding everywhere before us. And what's worse than death is what's happening to all these children.
Yeah, it's disgusting to think that these things happen, and hard to understand how anyone could do that, until you realize that to be capable of doing something that sick, that they themselves would have also been traumatized in some severe way.
Yeah, I mean, like, you can't really justify the moral empowerment of a society in which 100% of survivors are traumatized. Instead of one where, you know, some people didn't make it, but everybody else found a way to live with that.
Yeah.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.